Happy Thanksgiving!
Friends and neighbors, we're back after a week off, and I hope you forgive our respite, as I know you love the pop culture discussions we have here on Taking It Down. Welcome back. In our last show, we discussed that first episode of the Netflix show, The Queen's Gambit, and today we're going to finish the whole series, wrap up our thoughts on the entirety of that. But before, we're going to talk about where pop culture and Thanksgiving intersect. If you like us, head over to the Alabama Take, the website behind this mess, and read our thoughts and opinions there. I've recently started a new column called What Else? Things we don't get to on this show, so be sure to check that out. But let's welcome back Adam and Donovan after a week off.
I'm feeling refreshed. I feel like we got a little time off, let the old mind grapes rest, and now they're firing on all cylinders.
Well, I feel like dog shit. I stayed up till 12 o'clock watching Rutgers in triple overtime lose to Michigan.
That game went to triple overtime?
It was double. Yeah, it was great. It was great. I mean, not for Rutgers or for Michigan. Really, for no one involved.
Not exactly, even you.
Exactly the kind of game you want Jim Harbaugh to win.
Oh, it was great.
A slugfest with Rutgers.
Guys, before we get in our first topic, I will preface it by saying I don't want to sound like a haughty hipster, but I preferred COVID's earlier work.
Like before more people were into it?
You know?
Discovered it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's clearly made it to a major label now, and it's kind of inescapable.
It's not even giving Don Jr. symptoms.
You know what?
Yeah, come on.
I mean, my parents are into it now, you know what
I mean? This is kind of like when, you know, we all just woke up and we found a U2 album on our computers, on our phones.
And on our phones.
That's what COVID's pulling that shit.
I was the only person that was pissed it wasn't on my phone. I was running around the job that I had at the time trying to find the best Wi-Fi because it wouldn't. Like, I could see people tweeting in disgust, and I was like, it's not on my phone. I'm the only person within a 200-mile radius probably that wants this on my phone, and I don't have it.
Speaking of albums, what a great segue, guys. You guys have thoughts on the new War on Drugs album that released Friday?
Well, let me say this. November 20th ended up being, I don't know why, but there was a lot of good music put out.
What am I missing? Because I think my mind went blank. What am I forgetting? War on Drugs Live.
War on Drugs Live is probably the biggest. You know, there's rare moments now in our fractured culture. And I mean that, like, even amongst friends, we all like different things and don't necessarily get our news from the same source and blah, blah, blah. Everyone that I knew was listening to that album that enjoys music. And that was kind of a fun thing to have a bit of monoculture for that Friday morning. The other records that I'm thinking about are kind of friend of the program, John Calvin Abney. You know, he plays in Tuscaloosa quite a bit and was a Glory Fire, a fellow stand-in guitar player. He put a record out.
Okay.
That is very good. If you're not familiar with him, he's the instrumentalist with John Moreland is embedded in that Tulsa scene.
Okay.
Very, very pleasant listening. Granddaddy put out a new collection of songs and like kind of B-sides and all of that. It's great. I feel like I'm missing something, Donovan. Weren't there a few other things?
Yeah, but my mind has also gone, much like Blaine, my mind has gone blank.
And maybe there was a new Andy Schaaf that came out. I know folks love him. Yeah, it was a joyous Friday to have new music again, especially with the live drugs thing.
That's been the one that's taken up my time, just because, what is it, like about an hour and 10 minutes, but it doesn't overstay. When I'm done listening to it, I can start at the beginning. It doesn't feel like it overstays its welcome, which is kind of fun. It's good driving music.
I love it.
Wasn't this album done in a different kind of way other than just straight live? Wasn't there something? I know it was put together piecemeal from different shows, but isn't there something else going on with it?
They may have even like flown different parts of different songs around. They've been kind of coy with how they put it together. I mean, I would love to know like what tracks are from where. I know that that Springsteen early box set, was it 75 to 85? Isn't that the...
Right.
That was an inspiration for them. I would think that everything on it is at least post Lost in the Dream. I mean, it obviously is because a lot of the songs are, but, you know, with the current band that they've been touring with. for the last half decade. But I would love to see, like, you know, with that Springsteen thing, it tells you this is from Tempe, Arizona. This is from blah, blah. I would love to, like, find out where the different elements are coming from. But that's some record nerd level stuff.
I tell you what, the only bad thing about this album, because it's such an exceptional live album, is it makes you kind of like, oh yeah, live music. Remember that?
I'm so glad that they, and I think I've read that they were going to do this anyway, but the timing of a pandemic year getting that, I don't know, I've been very drawn to live music this year. And I, like, in high school and college, I loved listening to, going on archive.org and listening to live stuff. And for whatever reason, I mean, I still did, but it wasn't as at the forefront of my musical experience as a listener. And I feel like, you know, just this year, hearing a crowd react to, like, a great moment or a guitar solo take off or whatever has just been so cathartic. And it was, I loved hearing a band that, I mean, I think that I've seen them live once, and Donovan, you saw them. Have you seen them just once?
I've seen them twice. I saw them open for someone, and then I saw them with you.
Right. That Iron City show that we saw, I looked it up. It was in 2015, so they had it. They had Lost in the Dream dialed in.
Mm-hmm.
And I get the impression that they're a band that any money that they started to make went, like, right back into gear, you know, before, like, other bands are like, oh, we should, you know, we're going to get the nicest tour bus. We're going to do blah, blah, blah. We're going to hire these people. It's like, no, just, we want the nicest preamps for the live. I mean, they basically carry a studio around.
Pay me in knobs.
Right. But that's the best sounding show that I've ever seen. Like, regardless of venue size or fame or anything like that, like, it just sounded incredible. And they were so good.
The first one time I heard them, they were at Bottle Tree. They were opening for Frightened Rabbit, you know, and Frightened Rabbit's fine, but I wasn't really there to see them. And this was right after Slave Ambient came out. And I tell you what, like, even, you know, Bottle Tree, usually the sound was pretty good, but, you know, it was a small space and all that. But man, like, I just walked out of there. Like, I went because I liked the album, and I walked out of there being just like, I'll show up wherever these guys are.
And that was very early day. They were still like a four piece, right?
They were real early. Yeah. That was Kurt Vile had just quit.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
I remember you and our buddy Dan Walker coming back from that show and just being like, this is incredible. There were a few times at Bottle Tree that, like, a band that I hadn't really spent that much time with, somebody would come back and say, hey, you need to listen to this.
Weirdly enough, I believe we talked about it on the radio show. You, me, and Blaine talked about Slave Ambient.
Sounds right.
On what was that? 90.1?
90.7.
91. That's right. 90.7.
WVUA gets a shout out today. Yeah, The War on Drugs is probably one of our favorite bands as a three-person group here today. And we've written about them on the site as well, as being one of America's greatest bands. Donovan inadvertently reminded me of an album that came out on Friday that I still haven't listened to in full, which is the Dirty Knobs, Mike Campbell's project.
You're welcome.
Yeah, there you go. I've heard a couple of songs, and some of them sound quite promising. They sound very Tom Petty-esque and, you know, somewhat replaceable for the lack of Tom Petty we'll be having.
You know, the one thing about Mike Campbell is he will make you, his love, there's certain people that, like, their love of a thing is just contagious. Like, the fact that he's still, like, we talked about his Instagram series of, like, I'm going to play this guitar part.
Yeah.
His reverence for those parts and for the guitar itself, I don't know. It's just so, that dude could just chill with his money and even wallow in the fact that, like, his friend was taken, not that they're young men, but that this thing has ended. But he's still out there making music. I don't know. It's so cool. Like, that interview, I think we all read it on that Stereo Gum had with him. That was just so joyful. Like, him remembering all these different experiences. He's a treasure.
For sure. And another guy we lost this much more recently this week, Alvin Holmes.
Oh, yeah.
Alvin Holmes, legend.
True legend.
Died Saturday. And everyone knows him for the beer the mini rant on beer.
What's wrong with the beer we got?
It's so great. And he was actually did a lot more for Alabama than just give us that wonderful legendary rant.
Yeah, he was unafraid to take a civil rights stand. That's for sure. And I saw a few people comment that he had a unique ability to understand a bill quickly and like its implications and the intended and not. So even though he's the most memeable person, well, I don't know. Jeff Sessions exists, so that's, it's a toss-up. But he was very memeable from Alabama.
Yes.
Quite a man.
Yeah, good guy, Alvin Holmes, seemed like. So here we go, guys. It's Thanksgiving week. It's our sacred American holiday of gluttony. It's the only holiday where the idea is just to eat, right?
What do you mean it's the only holiday where the point is just, what the hell is Halloween?
Dressing up, acting like someone else, getting scared. There's
no, that shit is all window dressing for the candy, which you eat. Like, if you don't dress up, you don't get candy. If you don't scare people, you don't get candy. Candy's an eating holiday too, Blaine.
It's much okay. Like 4th of July, the fireworks, the patriotism is all just window dressing for eating outside,
yeah.
Gluttony. Eating actual barbecue and what people near Donovan would call a barbecue, meaning hamburgers.
It makes me so mad because now I've started doing it. Like, oh, well, why barbecue? I'm like, God damn it. No, it's not barbecue. You're cooking out, damn it.
You're grilling.
Yeah. You're grilling out.
Well, yeah. The point Big of the 4th there. Of July is to scare the shit out of my cats. Like, we all know why that holiday exists.
What are your general thoughts on Thanksgiving, though, that now that we, all jokes aside? You know, it used to be really short. I can remember in elementary school and even into high school that we only got the Thursday and Friday off. We would have to even go up until Wednesday. Now, I notice a lot of schools are just taking a whole week off. High schools take a whole week off.
I don't know about that.
Is it not the case?
Well, I'm saying I don't know about that as the approach to the holiday. I mean, I feel like we had like Wednesday half days or something.
Yeah, and then you got Thursday, Friday.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
I'm a little older than you guys.
Yeah. Taking the whole week, though, what's the point? You're about to hit Christmas break.
Absolutely. You lose all that class. I guess maybe they figure no one's paying attention anyway.
That's true.
Blaine, you're a teacher. Is it a teacher mental health thing?
in part, for sure. And heads of families need to get ready for Thanksgiving. I remember my mother working all day on Wednesday. She had a factory job, and she worked with all day on Wednesday and then would be really stressed about trying to get anything ready for Thursday.
Oh, I bet.
So it's kind of overrun by Christmas now, you know? I think everybody knows that. And I think we even have a lot of people in our society that accept that. They're cool with that, and that's fine. I mean, there's no right or wrong answer.
We're floating in outer space right now in terms of when Christmas should begin in our COVID year. Like, we already have our lights are on our tree out front. That's our one contribution to the Christmas landscape around here. And I saw neighbors putting theirs up, and she did it last weekend, and we waited until this Friday, so within a week of Thanksgiving, to actually turn the sucker on. But I love Thanksgiving.
Yeah, tell me more. Tell me
why.
I think for me, it's tied to we would alternate which mom or my mom or dad's family to go to, and usually it wouldn't coincide with Christmas, so you got a mix of each over the course of the holiday season. But you go somewhere and like Christmas, you're kind of expected. Like, well, are you coming for Christmas Eve? Are you going to come a day early? Are you going to stay a day? And it's like it just becomes this amorphous blob of a time of, you want to talk about gluttony. You eat the meal and then you eat the leftovers and you're just sitting around watching college football, which, hey, I don't hate, but at the same time, Thanksgiving, you just get in, get out of there one day. Love it.
I like, this is going to sound very cheesy, but I like the theoretical underpinnings of the holiday and that it is a day to be grateful. If you pretty easy to make yourself wild and forget that. And I think a lot of folks have sort of made a golden calf, if you will, of getting together with their family and doing everything just right. But I think at the end of the day, I like what it's about. I like that. And I like that it is seasonal, right? Like the harvest is in, the winter is coming up here, right? The leaves are gone, and we're getting ready to...
Well, damn it, Donovan, your sincerity kills my jokes.
Oh, well, I can talk about all the absolute racist and shit stuff that I'm... was taught in preschool about Thanksgiving to balance it out.
That's the weird thing is like how much I love Thanksgiving and also it being one of the worst offenders in terms of national holidays.
It is just, I think I was four when I remember learning this stuff. So this would have been 1993. I'm almost certain that everybody involved knew better.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the clash of pop culture and Thanksgiving then. Do you have any favorite episodes of TV or movies, books, music associated with Thanksgiving? And there's a lot more than I thought when I started really taking notes of what things I remember from Thanksgiving in pop culture.
I mean, there's the classics. One recent one, and I'm sure Donovan will join me on this, is Bob's Burgers does a great job with Thanksgiving. It's the title character's favorite holiday. So it's often gets a nice treatment from the writer's room. Really, absolutely, any of their Thanksgiving episodes, I'm in for.
I think my favorite one is where Bob drinks too much absinthe.
Classic.
And starts to talk to his turkey. That's probably their best one, but they're all very
solid.
The
one where he keeps buying turkeys because he thinks someone's stealing it while it's being cooked overnight, and turns out he's sleepwalking and putting it in the toilet, right?
Yeah, it's going in the toilet.
And the guy that's selling him the turkey at the deli or at the supermarket or whatever thinks that he's coming on to him the whole time, and it's just a man, that's a great episode.
That has a great Aunt Gail bit where she has to stay with them because she had a fight with her cat. She can't be with him right now.
It's good stuff.
Which is that's very real. That happens all the time to me.
The other one from the animated world... I always seem to go there on these holiday questions. The King of the Hill, where Bobby becomes woke, Bobby Hill.
That's a very good episode.
Absolute classic. But, you know, there's John Redcorn, the Indian character, is attempting to reach out to his son by way of Dale Gribble and ends up hooking Bobby instead. And Bobby sets up a table that's, you know, at the big Thanksgiving feast, hating on the tradition. Is it also a Thanksgiving episode or is it a Christmas episode where they get stuck at the airport, Donovan? I can't remember because Hank has a turkey the whole time.
I can't remember either.
Anyway, great episodes there.
The one Adam brought up with John Redcorn is actually really like, it's got a really serious heart to it where like, you know, like, the King of the Hill could get very serious very fast, where like John Redcorn really has kind of lost everything and he's trying to rebuild and he's trying to like pass his heritage on to someone that, you know, he can't even acknowledge as his son.
It's a tragic comedy for sure.
It's very funny, but it's a very good, very serious episode.
And there's a few moments where Joseph learns what John Redcorn's people, as they want to say on the show, did, you know, cannibalism or whatever, and he just seems horrified and kind of like talks about how gross it is, and you see John Redcorn's face. You're like, man, this is, like you say, this is sad.
It's serious, especially like, right, like in really the context of the show, right? Like John Redcorn is great, but also like he is a great tragic comic character, right? Because he's got real tragedy in his life.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he sings for Big Mountain Fudge Cake.
Classic. Tom Petty on bass.
One of the few movies I could come up with, maybe the only one that I personally could come up with, is Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Have you guys seen that classic?
Not for a long time.
I haven't. Yeah. It's a gap in my watching history.
So yeah, it involves Steve Martin trying to get home for Thanksgiving. It's got one of the lines I still quote to this day is, "She's short and skinny, but she's strong."
Now I was able to come up with another movie for you.
Oh, do tell.
The 97 Ang Lee movie, The Ice Storm. It's based off of the Rick Moody novel.
And that's a Thanksgiving based story?
It takes place over Thanksgiving, right? Like they get it's Thanksgiving weekend in whatever, the 70s or 80s, I forget. And this family in Connecticut, this wealthy family gets stuck together, right? Because there's an ice storm. and like Sigourney Weaver's in it, Elijah Wood's in it, Kevin Kline, I think, is in it.
Hmm.
Your mileage may vary because it's very much a Ang Lee prestige piece, right? And did the book win a National Book Award? So I guess there's the book too.
Kind of by the same token, apparently Paul Blart Mall Cop is considered a Thanksgiving film.
Wait a minute.
Sure.
How's that possible?
Sounds right to me.
I don't know. Is it Black Friday based? I don't know. I've never actually seen.
Yeah, me either. Oh, we got the Drive By Trucker song Thanksgiving Filter. It's obvious it's in the title, but it does a nice job of kind of summarizing what we probably have to go through with some family members in Thanksgiving.
Got some classic Patterson vocals on that one.
That's true. Good vocals there. And guys, I don't know if you remember this or I'm misremembering this. And it could be the best Thanksgiving moment of them all. Mad Men's The Wheel. Is that not a Thanksgiving episode where Don does not want to spend the holiday with Betty's family? And then it's the last episode of the first season. And
does Don's that take place on Thanksgiving?
I think it takes place over the course of Thanksgiving.
Because they're leaving. Right, and he rushes to get home, right? And he's going to go with them after all.
They've already left.
And it includes Don's famous emotional pitch for Kodak.
That's his best
click.
Moment.
So that, if that counts as a Thanksgiving, we might want to double check it. I'm pretty sure that's over the course of Thanksgiving.
I've looked it up, yeah. It's because Don elects not to spend Thanksgiving with Betty's family.
That's got to be the best moment in pop culture for Thanksgiving.
That's probably one of Don's more relatable moments. Like, yeah, I get it. I don't want to spend Thanksgiving with my in-laws either. Like,
we met his in-laws. They're terrible.
That's right.
Grandpa Gene.
I'll toss out some more. You guys give me your thoughts. And if anything else comes to mind, chime in. We got this one is a Thanksgiving episode, and I kind of have forgotten it as well. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, season 9, episode 10. The gang squashes their beefs, which brings in the McPoyles, but also Bill Ponderosa and Rickety Cricket. You remember this episode at all?
Not even a little bit.
Okay. I'm having trouble, to be honest, because I have watched them in big, long spurts, and they kind of get jumbled together.
That's me too.
If you want to make me smile or laugh or even chuckle, just say the name Bill Ponderosa, and I probably will start.
When you said Bill Ponderosa and Rickety Cricket, I just started laughing.
I mean, that's all you need.
Rickety Cricket.
So that is a Thanksgiving episode. When I do think of Thanksgiving episodes or pop culture, I do immediately think Drive-By Truckers. I think Planes, Trains, Automobiles first. Are in that first group of thoughts. And probably the other immediate thought I have is the Cheers episode where they're actually outside of the bar and they're at Carla's house and it ends in a food fight.
I have never seen that.
It's really good.
I'll watch it.
No, it's like one of the best Cheers. It's probably whenever you look up these listicles where they talk about the best episodes of Cheers, it always ends in the top three.
Is it WKRP in Cincinnati had the episode where they were doing the turkey promotion?
That is probably the most famous episode where they're dropping turkeys off of the building.
Right. Scott is my witness. I thought turkeys could fly.
That is a great punchline.
That's a good one.
Talk about well-written sitcoms. They were doing it in the 70s and 80s. So there you go. There are other Thanksgiving episodes that I could not recollect, but
I mean, the Peanuts is always in the mix for a holiday.
Yes, of course.
We should do a roundup of Thanksgiving episodes, but only shows whose creators have been canceled. So that would be Cosby Show and Louie, respectively, which I'm sure had one.
Remind me of Louie's Thanksgiving episode.
I don't know, but I bet it had one. Oh. Seems like the kind of thing he would have. Same thing with Cosby Show. I can't think of it, but I'll bet they had one.
You gotta think of it.
The Office had one. The Simpsons has had one.
Yeah.
And the Sopranos, though, you don't really connect the Sopranos to holiday episodes. They do have a very good Thanksgiving episode where Tony's sister has discovered Christianity. And she and her new boyfriend are going around the room to everybody and saying, have you heard the good news? And whenever someone says what, they say, "He is risen."
He is risen.
It just pisses Tony off every time he hears it. Pretty good episode right there. You could probably watch that one as a standalone. And I'll just throw out my most hated maybe episode of television ever. Maybe. Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Okay. I'll say it and I can always amend it later. And it involves Thanksgiving. It's How I Met Your Mother. And they did an episode called Slapsgiving where they just went around slapping one another. And I hated that concept and I hate that show.
Well, why'd you watch it?
Yeah, you lost me or I agreed with hating it when you said what the show it is.
One of those things where I was in the room when it was on and I had no control of the television.
You were getting Clockwork Oranged?
Damn near.
You were getting reprogrammed.
This fits perfectly in our discussion of Thanksgiving. When you're at someone else's house.
Yes, that.
Extended hours of time, you have no control over their television and you're just sitting there.
That's why God put football on Thanksgiving. Because exactly. Even if you can't agree on anything, everyone can boo the Cowboys, right?
And a parade. Everybody can watch a parade and everybody can watch the fucking Cowboys and Lions games.
I don't know. I think the Macy's Day Parade, you get things like, oh, Sesame Street's getting too politically correct now.
I know. Like, but you know what, guys? Okay, I'm getting a little sentimental here. But I think it's welcome over the holiday season. I'm sort of excited this year for Thanksgiving Parade because Andy is full-blown aware of everything now. And so maybe she will enjoy the parade because I can remember being a kid and being five, and the parade gave me a little joy. Do you remember
this? Balloons are great.
Oh, yeah. I loved waking up, and I would usually be at a grandparent's house and, like, go, and the TV would be on, and the parade's going, and Grandma's cooking breakfast or whatever. Yeah, those are like fond memories.
Grandpa's not drunk yet, right? I mean, good memories.
Well, classic stuff. I mean, depends on how late you got up. You know, parade's still going on at 10 a.m., Lane.
I mean, it's hard to argue that Thanksgiving Day has some of the best programming, right? Like you got the parade and then they have the NFL on literally all day. And then at night, the Egg Bowl happens.
Oh.
And the Egg Bowl.
Bad news. The Egg Bowl's on Saturday this year.
That's ridiculous.
Did they kick the pee-pee man out?
I'm not even sure who that player is.
I mean, like, when that happened last year, and I had been at Nat's parents for a while, and her dad is not shy with the dispersal of beverages. It's like, it was a great moment in Thanksgiving history.
That Josh, if we want to talk about Thanksgiving popular favorite episodes of Thanksgiving popular culture,
2019 Egg Bowl.
Egg Bowl 2019 for your consideration.
Yeah,
it absolutely counts. That is a legendary moment of Thanksgiving.
Oh, it was a lot of things coming together. But in a way that, like, if you watch it, it kind of makes America make more sense.
It makes Mississippi make more sense.
It gives you a little fondness, while at the same time makes you wish you didn't live there.
Donovan, I await your essay on this.
Hell no.
All right, let's take a break here, and when we come back, we'll talk more about the Queen's Gambit. Well, one thing we're thankful for, and that's anyone who takes a bit of time to listen to us. Why not share us with a friend? They may want to listen. You never can tell. You can help the cause, which would be the cost of podcast hosting and keeping your website going, by visiting buymeacoffee.com/thealabamatake or visit the website The Alabama Take and click on shop to get there. Let's get back into the show and talk about The Queen's Gambit. All right, so The Queen's Gambit, we talked about the first episode only in our 2 weeks ago, and I'll just run through a quick overview again. It's this Netflix show. It's set in the late 1950s orphanage. Young girl displays this prodigious skill of chess. She becomes a star as she gets a little older and runs into a few addiction issues. The young lady ends up being played by Anna Taylor-Joy, and it's based on a 1983 Walter Tevis piece of fiction by the same name. Now, we are going to spoil the series. We're going to talk about very specific things. So if you haven't seen episodes 2 through 7, which I think is 7 episodes long, you might just want to come back after you finish the show. But before you leave us, I'll say I highly recommend it. I think it was a fine very enjoyable show. You guys want to give a very spoiler-free thought before we dive in?
You guys are going to kill me, but it's something was just not clicking for me with this one. I don't know what.
Interesting.
Everything felt like it was just slightly off.
I thought it was really good. I thought that it makes sense that it was the number one show on Netflix. I think I said that when we talked about it briefly a couple weeks ago. Pop appeal, sure, but good acting and people, the escapism of getting lost in this little world of chess and smart 50s, 60s fashion. I get why it was huge.
Yeah, it did have some of that mad. They had great sets. Wonderful set design.
Yeah.
And very, very, I hate that I sound so negative about it, because I think the camera and a lot of the directing was very, very sharp. And I think that everything they did with the chess games, they absolutely nailed it. They actually made it suspenseful. It was great.
Let's get into some specifics then and try to dissect what it is that hindered you from enjoying it, maybe.
I was pretty drunk most of the show, so maybe that was it.
It doesn't help.
Did you happen to take tranquilizers? Yeah.
I tried to drink to make myself better at chess, and it just, I don't know, maybe I didn't drink enough.
You didn't take generic tranquilizers that are always green, no matter what country you're in?
Looks like Prozac, if you ask me.
So here's one thing that you might have found distancing from the show, Donovan. But you've read the book, so I don't know.
I have read the book.
So did you find it, a lot of the characters, hard to read because of, I thought the show did a good job of playing with these tropes that we as viewers bring to the table, and they would kind of hint that this might happen. I kept expecting the mother, for example, to bamboozle Beth, her adopted daughter. I kept thinking that she would try to rob her or take advantage of her or get too drunk that she starts beating her or something. I kept waiting for that other shoe to drop. And
they really hinted never, at it.
It did hint. It just kept like wanting to foreshadow that, and then it would use that expectation against you.
Tevis does, that's right out of the book. Tevis does something very similar. Although I actually found for the show that they kind of made Alma more complex than in the book, and I'm not really sure if it worked for me. Like one of the great things about Alma was there was a, like, I feel like it's hard to pull this off, but there was kind of a lot of like what you see is what you get with her, and she was not content. She wasn't stupid, but she didn't quite have the emotional depth or the ability to articulate that. And there's an excellent line in the book where when Mr. Wheatley finds out, or is it Mrs. Wheatley? Whatever, Alma, finds out that you can make money doing chess, and she, you know, calls the school and makes up an excuse for Beth, and Beth is like, Beth was impressed at Mrs. Wheatley's dishonesty, which nearly matched her own.
That's good. That's good.
But I did feel that that's kind of true to the book. I think the characters are a little enigmatic, right? Beth kind of grows up a lot on her own in the book. You can kind of describe Alma's attitude to her as benign neglect more than anything else.
She seems to finally, I don't know, like enjoy something. Like she's taking pride in what she's doing. I don't know, that relationship coalesced and went in a direction that I didn't expect. Because that moment where she says, you can make money doing this, I thought, well, now there's going to be some secret bank account and blah, 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 and it'll add to the drama, but not so.
Around episode 5, this is where Harry comes to live with her after her mother dies, Alma, her adopted mother. I was teetering on Taylor Joy's performance here. It was still ambiguous, but at the same time, I think that kept me continuing to watch and be interested. And there was this, I thought she did a pretty good job with her performance. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if this doesn't propel her into a lot more things. Not that she wouldn't have already gotten there, but she kept this kind of glaze over her eyes that kept viewers at a distance on reading her, which I found compelling.
You know what I think she was doing, and I don't think 100% of the time it worked, possibly because she's a little younger, but I felt that she was doing something akin to what, especially in the first season or first couple episodes of Mad Men, Jon Hamm was so good at doing with his face, where he was so good at letting you know that there was something going on. There's something going on inside this guy, but you're not quite sure what.
Yeah.
What's he thinking? What's he feeling? How's he reacting to these things?
I think where the show maybe took a misstep was it had that kind of, she was pulling that off, but instead of relying on that, they showed too much at times. You know, like,
yes,
like Don is often in the midst of a descent. If you are kind of keeping track of how many drinks he had at the office that day, where he should be when he's somewhere else, all those kind of things, it's a much more subtle hand. Whereas Queen's Gambit was just kind of like, all right, now she's falling around her house because she can't deal with, you know, like it was just more on the nose, which makes sense that it's made for mass consumption. So they both show and tell a lot of the time instead of mm-hmm. just one or the other. But I mean, she did give that kind of performance. And I think, you know, I thought she was great in The Witch. And I know that she's lined up for more film work after this. Pandemic dependent, I guess, but yeah, I mean, I thought her performance was strong.
Yeah, I 100% agree with Adam. It wasn't Anna Taylor. Is it Anna Taylor Joy? I always mm-hmm. get her mixed up.
That's correct.
It wasn't Anna Taylor Joy. It was the writing and the directing, and the director's name just went out of my head. The director and creator, but whatever he is. He's very talented, and he certainly knows he can make beautiful television and movies, but he's not subtle. So if you're looking for subtlety, you know, that ain't going to be, you're not going to get it from him. And I think her performance was maybe, I think this was kind of maybe part of what was a little half off for me is sometimes it seemed like she was making a performance that would have fit better with some other show. Because this one wasn't really that interested in that kind of enigma, not really. It thinks it is.
Interesting. Yeah, there was a moment for me. It was a signal that the show knew what it was doing, but perhaps definitely not subtle. I think it was in the penultimate episode where her guardian / adoptive father wants the house back, and the camera shifts its angle mid-sentence for both of them to sort of signal to the viewer the power shift between the two of them, where she kind of says, I will buy the house from you. And then the camera just visibly moves.
Someone went to film school.
the sets were absolutely amazing. I was, the Las Vegas set at the U.S. Open was, I couldn't believe how big and sprawling that set was. I thought about how expensive it had to have been to make that.
Yeah. Yeah, production values were extremely high on this one.
You know, you think about like an HBO show like The Plot Against America, where they're able to build these sprawling town centers. You know, they're supposed to be in New Jersey, and there's a lot of activity, and you think about all the cars going around. You're like, well, HBO's got the money. I guess Netflix does too, because there was a lot of moments where,
yeah,
you know, like her going to the drugstore and mm-hmm. kind of being just totally in that world. It felt very immersive. I guess would be the phrase. And even though there were moments where, you know, there's crucial moments on an airplane, say, like, that's pretty easy to do a contained set like that, or the orphanage, or these tournaments, but it breathed a lot more than that. The world building was definitely not an issue.
Donovan, you talked about how the director and the creator didn't have a subtle hand. So what did you think about when they did not show her win over Benny and instead just immediately shifted to them drinking at the bar?
That was fine.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, you know, I'm
not trying to, no, I'm just saying, like, I'm not trying to convince you because I think your opinion is absolutely valid, but tell me what, like,
I'm trying to articulate it well.
Did you think that was an odd choice?
No. I don't really think so. You know, it is not something that really struck me because at the time, although as being odd or not odd. Probably, I don't know. My overwhelming feeling watching this was the writing is just not quite there. And some of the other actors around her are not quite up to her caliber. And, you know, there were little like story tricks and things like that where I'm like, oh, that's neat and that works and it flows well. But the overall effect is still just not 100% working for me.
Yeah, I think like that move of her just winning that, one, it was kind of undercut by the, as they're playing speed chess or whatever and gambling, like you kind of know where it's going.
Mm-hmm.
But that reveal was nice. But then at the end, when she gets the phone call in Russia and it's like a familiar voice, and then you realize that the gang's all here to like coach her through, it's like, come on, y'all.
Yeah, in fact, the only problem I think I really had of the series was the last 30 or 35 minutes where it kind of got hackneyed. That last Borgadov match or whatever the Russian's name was that kept reoccurring as sort of her nemesis. It was a bit disappointing that she had to rely on the men for help, but I guess that's sort of needed for her arc to come full circle to sort of prove to us that she's no longer alone or distancing herself from people like she had been from the orphanage on, right?
Well, and they'd set it up early that, I can't remember which character says it, that the Russians are tough to beat because you're not just playing one of them. They're all working together. And then they even show it when she's in Paris that they're all working out how to beat her jointly. And for her to finally, her style is described as kind of not impulsive, but she doesn't play from a textbook and blah, blah, blah. And for her to finally learn from it was the point, I guess. But it's like just bashing you over the head with it.
And it was predictable that the Bill Camp character, Mr. Scheibold, would have kept up with her, would have kept newspaper clippings of her and things. But for that to happen off camera and for her to return to see it for herself, that still packed a bit of a punch for me. And
I agree.
That had a really great moment because she really held a lot of her emotions in check as an actress. And then she gets to let it go right there somewhat.
It's a sweet moment.
Yeah. And the Bill Camp character was a sweet character to me.
There's an alternate universe where that's a scene from a horror movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
It sure could be.
I will say one thing that kind of bugged me or just made me roll my eyes was her means of getting to that point, to the orphanage again, via her friend who has become this, strong. Yeah, Jolene has become, as you would expect from her early interactions, strong young black woman in a time where that was difficult and she has no shits to give about the world around her, but she's come at a pivotal moment for her friend, for Beth's development. And it's like, oh, this is exactly what Hollywood and writers have been doing for the last century, is introducing this magical character to shepherd the white person's emotions in a crucial time. It's like,
I agree. And it hit me the same. So yeah, the last episode as a whole, it was shaky to me. Everything up until the last episode was pretty good, though. I do have some questions. I'll toss it to you guys. Do we want to comment on Benny's attire?
Bothersome. Do you think the jacket stays on all the time?
He was wearing that at the. You notice he's in the episode too. He's on one of the chess magazines, isn't he? And I think he's wearing the exact same thing.
Yeah,
which is supposedly like. It's like 5 years. It's like 5 years before. So it's like,
does he ever earn that way of dressing?
I mean, he's famous as a chess player. He sells books. That's like how he's making his money, right?
His quick draw chess pieces here.
Ridiculous.
My second question's a little bit more serious. Did you ever figure out the reason we kept getting these glimpses at Borgdorf's family and him being a father? They were very quick, but it almost felt like we were supposed to take something from that.
Yeah, in the book, I don't think it 100% works here, but in the book, like, he's just this figure that she loathes him, right? and she's seen him once, and she like, but it's like that she can't imagine him except this kind of like ogre-ish figure that she has to overcome. And then, you know, it kind of, it's just that, you know, it's, I think it's supposed to be that thing, right, where you see your teacher at the grocery store and you're like, wait, does she have a life outside of school? But I'm not 100% sure it worked.
Well, there was some implied danger to being like a Russian figure, right? Like his performance or his behavior has actual physical ramifications, like the KGB agents being with him in Mexico, but making it to where, you know, this guy is kind of in a pickle of, she doesn't really have anything to lose. Whereas if his value in society is literal value, not just like popularity, is tied to success. That seemed to be they never really pursued that. I thought they were going to a bit more that, you know, he can't defect, or even if he wants to, again, not explored, but that it means something different to him than it does to her.
Yeah, it felt half, maybe this is, it felt a little underdone.
It did.
You know, and I think, I guess that's kind of what I've been thinking for the whole show, is I think it felt a little underdone to me. And I'm trying to think of how to, it was done, it was very pretty. I guess sometimes I felt like that it was more style over substance. Mm.
And I say it did, and I'm actually agreeing with you, because I felt the last episode proved that it was a little underdone. Now, everything up until that was great for me. And even the ending, this nice little pat ending where she jumps, or not jumps, she gets out of the car in Russia and decides to go to the park area where all the common people are playing chess. And she sits with an older man, and it's kind of a circles back to her learning from an older man when she was a kid. I thought that it was okay, but at the same time, undercooked.
I didn't mind the ending at all. It's just when it's tacked on to what had happened for the previous 15 minutes, it doesn't stand the same way as if the previous 15 had been handled well.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think that's it.
Yep, I agree.
It's one of those things where, like, there are elements that are so good, like her performance or the sets or, you know, anything that we've discussed, that it really throws into relief. I think of the phrase, like, you paint one part of your house and realize, oh, shit, now I got to do the whole thing. the parts that don't look good are really, there's a bright light shining on them.
Yeah.
Yep.
Good show overall for me.
I'll give it a solid B minus.
Yeah. Yeah, I think a good B.
That's probably where I'd say B minus. I mean, I don't think it was like a disaster or anything.
No, absolutely not. Very enjoyable.
I wasn't miserable. There were good things done, you know. What else are we going to do? We all got Rona now.
That's right. All right, guys, that's it. Folks, we appreciate you listening. Happy Thanksgiving to you all. If you're listening during this week of Thanksgiving, message us, rate us, review us, and let us know how we're doing. And what we'll do is we'll talk to you next Tuesday, and we're going to comment on the first episode of FX's Black Narcissus. See you then.
Narcissus. Yeah.